Bhaktivedanta Swami Nitya Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Bachana Nivasesa Sanyavani Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutana Bhaktivedanta Shri Guru and Vaishnavas Shri Rupam Sadhvatatam Sadhana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sadivam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Purjana Saita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahana Sahana Shri Vishakam Vitam Sacham Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So May 6, 2009, here at the Loft in Auckland, and we're reading from Bhagavad Gita, text 11 through 20. Okay, read together. The endeavoring transcendentalists who are situated in self-realization. Can you read together? Ready? The endeavoring transcendentalists who are situated in self-realization can see all this clearly. But those whose minds are not developed nor are not situated in self-realization cannot see what is taking place, although they may try. The splendor of the sun, which dissipates the darkness of this whole world, comes from me. And the splendor of the moon and the splendor of fire also come from me. By my energy, they stay in orbit. I become the moon and thereby supply the juice of life to all vegetables. I am the fire of digestion in the bodies of all living entities, and I join with the air of life, outgoing and incoming, to digest the four kinds of foodstuffs. I am situated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas, I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. There are two classes of beings, the fallible and the infallible. In the material world, every living entity is fallible, and in the spiritual world, every living entity is called infallible. Besides these two, there is the greatest living personality, the Supreme Soul, the imperishable Lord himself, who has entered the three worlds and is maintaining them. Because I am transcendental beyond both the fallible and the infallible, and because I am the greatest, I am celebrated both in the world and in the Vedas as that Supreme Person. Whoever knows me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, without doubting, is a knower of everything. He therefore engages himself in full devotional service to me, O son of Bharata. This is the most confidential part of the Vedic scriptures, O sinless one, and it is disclosed now by me. Whoever understands this will become wise, and his endeavors will know perfection. So remember, the first five verses of this chapter dealt with the tree. Right. Now this section, we're dealing, the rest of the chapter is then Purushottam Yoga, or the Yoga of the Supreme Person. And here it's being emphasized how everything is Krishna. Lots of places in the Bhagavad Gita where that's emphasized. What other places in the Bhagavad Gita does Krishna describe himself in terms of the world? Seven?
Ten?
Nine. Okay. 7, 9, 10, and 15. And these are very important places for us because we're in the world. And we probably have more or less materialistic vision and materialistic consciousness. We see the world. We taste the world. We smell the world. We experience the world. And Prabhupada many, many times, so many times, when he was asked, "Have you seen God?" he'd say, "I'm seeing the sunshine." Don't you see the sunshine? Don't you drink water? How can you say you've not seen God? So seeing Krishna is not just, it is also, but it is not just some mystical thing that you see, you know, Nandanandana walking in your room playing his flute. That's also very nice. But that we can factually experience Krishna within the world. And then Krishna talks about three verses, 16, 17, 18, which are considered, you remember in chapter 10, 8, 9, 10, 11, where the seed verses, well, these are also considered seed verses of the Bhagavad Gita, 16, 17, 18. There's fallible and infallible. Above that is God, and that's me. So that's also the essence. It's the essence of what's called sambandha, our relationship. And then in 19 is actually quite similar to 10, 8. If you know that Krishna is the Supreme Lord, you know his opulences, then you'll serve him. It's also interesting, without doubting, which reminds us of 7.1. And Krishna keeps telling us that this is confidential in text 20. That's also a recurring theme, that this is confidential. And what's also important here is that Anaga, that Krishna, that Arjuna is sinless. All right. So going back to text 11, that the only way that one's going to understand this, now, what's this? That relates back to the previous verses. What's this that Krishna's talking about? The endeavoring transcendentalist who is in self-realization can see all this clearly. What's this? Everything's happening under the modes of material nature. What else?
That the living entity is separate from his body.
That the living entity is separate from his body. And?
How we can quit the body.
Hmm?
How we can quit the body.
How we get a body according to our desires. I was just hearing Prabhupada say that this morning, again, in prayers of personified Vedas. How we have this body according to our desires. It's one of the main themes of this part of Bhagavad Gita, isn't it? 13, 14, 15 chapter. This body is a gross manifestation of our desires. Try meditating on that during the day. Is this body very nice? No. I mean, is there practically anything that comes out of it that's pleasing? Maybe tears. But, I mean, practically all the substances that come out of this body are revolting. In fact, if we were to see a pile, just a random pile of body elements, you know, even the things we really like eyeballs, you know, it's horrible. Now, if you just think about it, I've been thinking about this recently. If this body, is a manifestation of our desires, what kind of desires do we have? Think about that for a minute. This body, what was this body made out of? Blood? And there's always some stool in our intestines and urine and pus and bones and hair. That means the things that we're desiring must be pretty disgusting. Or the nature of our desires must be pretty bad. Because this body is a manifestation, it's a gross manifestation of our heart, our mind. You are what you think. That's not to get discouraged, but it's to get us to be humble and honest. What is it I'm really desiring? I was speaking with one devotee just a couple days ago who was saying, I wish I could help my husband. He gets so angry and bitter. I said, every conditioned soul is always angry at Krishna. And she said, no, I'm not. She said, sometimes I feel angry, but generally I'm not angry at Krishna. She was arguing with me. So I said, you know, look, this is too hard for me to explain. I don't think I can explain this very well. I said, why don't you just ask Krishna to show you? So then she called me up later that day and she said, boy, Krishna works really fast, and she was crying. She said, all my anger in this world is I'm actually angry at Krishna. I said, yeah. So it's a hard thing for us to accept, though. We think, no, I'm not like that. I don't have nasty material desires. I'm a nice person. All right. So therefore, others can't see it, although they may try. They may try to see what's going on, but they can't. Why can't they? Why does one have to be somewhat advanced in self-realization to see what's going on? Because it requires some humility and honesty. Requires some connection with truth. Remember, we're talking about that sattva gun, mode of goodness. Sattva also means truth. It means goodness, that means truth. One has to be willing to see the truth, and most conditioned souls are not willing to see the truth. In fact, Prabhupada says the reason that one doesn't fall down at the stage of bhava is that one sees the naked form of material desires. One sees them honestly. And because we don't see material desires honestly, therefore, it's hard for us to understand what's going on here. But to understand what's going on takes a lot of honesty and a lot of humility. I've been told by devotees who do preaching programs in prisons that practically every prisoner claims that they're innocent. Hardly any of them will say, yeah, I really murdered somebody. Actually, a book my son lent me, How to Win Friends and Influence People, one of the things that the author, very famous book, Dale Carnegie, said no one ever wants to admit that they're wrong. And he gave the example of horrible criminals. You know, murderers, people who'd murder in cold blood just to get money. And they would have some excuse about why they weren't really so bad. They'd say, oh, I just killed in self-defense or something like that. You know, they had some story to explain their behaviors. So one who's not in self-realization is see things clearly. They can't see things. Things become, they're covered by, we were talking about how the modes act like a filter. But why are we in association with the modes? Because of our desires. Everything's situated on desire. So as long as I desire to enjoy this world, I am covered by the modes and I cannot see things clearly. Does that make sense? I think about people who eat meat. Can people who eat meat generally speaking, can they really think about what they're doing? I mean, even people that are slaughtering their own animals, do they really think about what they're doing? They can't. They have to explain it in some way, isn't it? They have to rationalize it somehow. They can't really face the fact of what they're doing. As soon as they face the fact of what they're doing, they'll have to stop. And if they don't want to stop, then they can't face what they're doing. Does that make sense? So if I want to be an illusion, then I can't face reality. Duh. Which means I can't see things as they are. All right. And Prabhupada talks about here in this purport that when Krishna is saying yogis, he doesn't mean just people doing exercises in the modern day. Krishna's not referring to those kind of yogis. That not just if you can do the, you know, what is it, downward dog. That if you can do that, then you can understand things as they are. He says, only those who are actually in the yoga system and have realized the self, the world, and the Supreme Lord. So those are the three things one has to realize. The self, the world, and the Supreme Lord. Only those people. Now, text 12. Splendor of the sun, splendor of the moon, splendor of fire. You do know there's nothing beautiful without light. Could there be anything beautiful without light? Without light, you couldn't see. Therefore, there'd be nothing beautiful. And light itself, of course, is also very beautiful. Have you ever noticed whenever there's a flame in the room, how you're drawn to it? You want to look at it? People will sit around a fire, look at a fire for a long time. It's very splendid. It's very attractive. We're constantly being surrounded by fire. Just like the fire from the sun is illuminating this room from the light bulbs, and the light bulbs are ultimately also getting their light from the sun. We've talked about that, how the light bulbs are getting their light from the sun. So if they're burning coal, the coal is from plants that got their light from the sun, or from oil, the oil is from plants that got their light, their energy from photosynthesis. Or even if it's hydroelectric power, it's the sun's power that's evaporating the water so that it comes down as rain. Any kind of electricity, any kind of light is coming from Krishna. So how splendid it is. Prabhupada says, if one can understand the light and splendor of the sun, moon, and fire emanating from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then one's Krishna consciousness will begin. How many times has Krishna described himself as the sun and the moon in the Bhagavad Gita? This is at least the third, maybe fourth time that he said that. So we're always in the presence of light. I mean, unless you go down into a copper mine or something. And we're certainly always in the presence of heat, because there's heat in our own bodies, which Krishna is also about to describe. And Prabhupada says here, by the moonshine, all the vegetables are nourished. Without his, which we'll read about in the next one, without his mercy, there cannot be sun. Without his mercy, there cannot be moon. Without his mercy, there cannot be fire. And without the help of sun, moon, and fire, no one can live. So this means that we can meditate on Krishna's presence at every moment, if we so choose to turn our attention that way. There's always some light, there's always some warmth, and it's something that's splendid. And that's Krishna. And then he says, I enter into each planet. By my energy, they stay in orbit. And Prabhupada talks about if you hold dust in your hand, it stays. And if you let go of your hand, it scatters. And that Krishna is holding the planets like that. Actually, you know, the planets are, they're sitting on the heads of Anantasesha, who hardly feels them. And that way they stay in orbit. I mean, it's pretty amazing that the planets stay in orbit. You can, years in advance, say where each of the planets are going to be. You know, the scientists say that everything started from a chunk that's infinitesimally small and infinitesimally dense, which is supernatural. How can something be infinitely small and infinite? How can anything be infinitely small, first of all? And how can something be infinitely dense, second of all? And how can something be both? I mean, there is something that's both. That's called Krishna. Andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam. Ekopisorachayatam jagadandakoti yachchakterasti jagadandachayayananta andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam. That Krishna is the smallest of the smallest, and inside of Krishna is the universe. Can you picture that? Try to picture that. That in every atom here, there's Krishna, and inside every Krishna, there's the universe. Does that make any sense? Makes no sense. When I was a kid, we had butter, Land O'Lakes butter, and on the cover was this American Indian, Native American girl holding a container of butter that had on it a picture of her holding a container of butter and so on ad infinitum, which really fascinated me when I was a child. How can that go on forever? So Krishna is the smallest of the smallest, and in him is the universe, and in every atom of the universe is Krishna, and in every atom of the universe is Krishna, who within him is the universe. Like Mother Yasoda, who looks inside Krishna's mouth and she sees herself. She doesn't see a vision of herself. She sees herself. And Lord Brahma says to Krishna, I don't understand how I'm inside your belly, but I'm talking to you outside. He said, I can't understand this. So that's inconceivable. So the scientists, in the name of getting rid of God, they propose something. They really are proposing a description of God. But they're saying it's matter. And then this little, tiny, infinitely small, infinitely dense something exploded and formed all the planets. Now, we don't generally find that explosions form something workable. So one devotee had this comedy routine of, these are the new dynamite builders. They take all of the things you want for your house, put them in your lot, and blow them up. And then you find there's your house with your granite countertops in the bathroom and your, you know, everything's there. The paintings on the wall. I mean, this is ridiculous. Explosions don't cause order, they cause disorder. If you put some dynamite under the building over there, it's not going to create galaxies. What to speak of a universe that's functioning in such a way that you can predict the moment, the movements of the planets and stars for thousands of years in advance. How is that possible? I mean, what airline or train system or bus system is that regulated? Is there any? The airlines would all love to run on time, but, you know, they can't. Right? Haven't you been in delayed flights? Probably many, 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 many times. But there's no, you know, there's no delay of Venus. It's not like Saturn gets delayed. There's not a notice, you know, we're very sorry. Saturn will not appear in the sky in its regular time because there's been a delay, there's been a strike. You know, the pilots are striking. If there's not a suitable demigod, Krishna expands and takes care of it himself. Hare Krishna. So this is the idea, there's some big bang, and from that comes all of the universe. And we're supposed to believe that as rational beings. And we're told that if we believe that there's people behind everything, then we're sentimentalists, then we're just primitive. Now, I don't know what explanation makes more sense. Let's say that there was an airline. Let's say Air New Zealand could say that for 20 years, every single one of their planes had been on time. And there was never an accident. Would we say, oh, that's just the result of an explosion? How insulting. If you went to the president of Air New Zealand, if he could say, we have been on time to the millisecond for 20 years. And you said, well, there's no people running this airline. That was just the result of a chance explosion. There's no intelligence behind the airline. How insulted would he be? Just imagine if you're a Pujari. When I was in Boston, the Pujari was really on top of the program, that everything had to be within 30 seconds. I mean, the planets are like within milliseconds, not 30 seconds. And everything had to be in 30 seconds. I know because one time I was putting my baby to sleep before I did the noon artique, and I fell asleep along with the baby. You know, just formula. She said, if you're ever late again, you'll never be allowed back on the altar. Often the head pujari was there at the altar with a stopwatch, making sure everything was within 30 seconds. So if you went to a temple where they could say that for the last 20 years, every offering had been done, every dressing, everything had been done to within a millisecond for 20 years, and you said, oh, that's just chance. How insulted would they feel? Isn't that insulting? There's no person behind anything. So what's more rational, that there's an intelligent person running things, or that it's all chance? Who's the more logical, scientific, rational person here? I mean, the scientific propaganda, our proper use of anger is to be angry at the people who are making such scientific propaganda and insulting Krishna. Such an insult to Krishna. Such an insult to Krishna. Just imagine if the head pujari was your best friend, right? And everything had always been on time for 20 years. And somebody walks in the temple room and said, oh, all the deity worship here, it just happens mechanically. There's nobody running the show. You'd feel angry, wouldn't you? How dare they insult my friend? And Prabhupada says, the more we kick on Darwin, the more we advance spiritually. This whole idea that everything's just chance, that it's just a machine. There's one, I don't know his name. It was a educational video somebody lent me for our school where this evolutionist says that when we look into space, the origin of everything is a cold, impersonal machine. I just read an article the other day in the New York Times about how people are turning to religion. And it said even people who weren't brought up in religious families tend to become religious. And the author said, we know evolution is a fact. And I thought, well, how do you know evolution is a fact? He said, but the problem is that all the hard, cold facts of science are so hard and cold. He said, He said, people are more than just like machines that eat and have sex desire. He said, we also are something beyond that, that's looking for something greater than ourselves. And I thought, yeah, science, the explanations of science are all hard and cold. They're all hard and cold and impersonal. They're not logical. They don't comport with our experience. And they're not satisfying for the self. How satisfying is it if you think that everything just comes down to something hard and cold and mechanical? Is that what we want? Is that what we're hankering for? So by several logics, one can understand that I don't ever see anything that's well ordered that's not the result of some personal intelligence. I just don't see it. It just never happens. The cars that we hear going on the street, you know what? That's all the result of ordered intelligence. Somebody's made the road, somebody's put the lines in the road, somebody's made the traffic laws, somebody enforces the traffic laws, somebody's made the automobiles, somebody's driving the automobiles. It's all intelligence. So first of all, I have that, just my logical experience. And why? Just because something's bigger and more complex, it can't be the result of an intelligent person? Does that make sense? It should be the opposite. Problem is that that person's so intelligent that then, as Krishna says later, you'll have to surrender to him. That's the problem. And the other logical understanding is that what do I want as a person? Like just this ordinary author said, people aren't satisfied with just hard, cold facts. It's not satisfying for the self. You can't lead a happy, fulfilling life. There's a part of yourself that's missing if you say everything's just made by an explosion. Also, if you say everything's just made by an explosion, that means it's purposeless. There's no reason for anything. The whole evolutionary philosophy is like that. Just, it was an accident. Everything exists due to an accident. The first life form because of an accident, and the fact that that first life gradually evolved into human beings is also the result of a series of billions and billions of genetic mutations, which means mistakes. So everything's just a mistake. It's just an accident. I mean, what's really the only thing you can do with that philosophy is commit suicide, practically speaking. You know, there's like, what is the... Or I guess you can try to enjoy by exploiting everybody else, because Darwin said that exploitation and competition is what brings things upward. So the more I try to take resources from you, the more fit that I am. If I really want society to progress upward, we'll have ruthless competition and envy and killing even. We'll kill the undesirable people. Isn't that his philosophy? That the undesirable of each species die out and only the most fit survive, and that's how things go upward? Isn't that what he's teaching? So if I want things to progress, then I'll kill undesirable people and I'll take the resources away from undesirable people. And isn't that what we see in modern society? That the most strong are taking the resources from the weak. No matter what kind of philosophy they spout, that's what they're actually doing, being influenced by this philosophy. And that's not exactly a very pleasing way to live. Okay. So when we see the stars, when we see the sun, the moon, we appreciate here's a person. And exactly like, we all want to be appreciated. Prabhupada says in the story of Krishna fighting with Jambavana over the Shamantaka jewel, that Krishna has all of the inclinations of an ordinary person. So when we eat breakfast this morning, the cook wants to be appreciated. That's natural. It's natural. Everybody wants to be appreciated. And Krishna does too. Krishna wants to be appreciated. And we all want to be appreciated also. Ultimately, we want to be appreciated by Krishna. Just reading how Vrindadevi tells Radha and Krishna, now all the six seasons of Vrindavan have come before you. There's different forests for each of the seasons in the spiritual world. And she said, they've decorated each season, which is person, has decorated the forest for your pleasure. Now please come and see them. And how the devotees want their service to be appreciated by Krishna. They want Krishna to say, oh, let's see how I've decorated the forest for you. See how I've cooked for you. That's where the devotee is getting their pleasure from. Krishna eats what they've cooked and Krishna smiles. Just like in ordinary life. You cook something for other people and they come and they say, oh, that's good. And that's your satisfaction. That's why you earn the money to buy the food. That's why you did the shopping. That's why you cut the veggies. That's why you worked over the hot stove, maybe even in the summer. That's why you scrubbed the pots. For that one moment of the person going, oh, that's really good. And you want your guests to eat more, don't you? It's a problem when you're a guest sometimes. You want them to like what you've done. So ultimately what we're wanting is that from Krishna. We're wanting Krishna to be happy with what we've done. And Krishna wants us to be happy with what he's done. He also feels that way. His pleasure is that we're happy with what he's done. It's a real give and take. So that's how we start our Krishna consciousness. To see, oh, there's the clouds. Look at that. There's the sun. How the sun is lighting up. And you can take yourself to this over and over. Now, such a wonderful thing here. Supply the juice of life to all vegetables. Rasa atmakaha. Of course, previously, Prabhupada says that Krishna said he was the taste of water. And here he says he's the taste of everything. There's wonderful, wonderful lectures on the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita where Prabhupada talks about how whatever we taste, that taste is Krishna. That whatever we taste, It says, do the moon's influence, the vegetables become delicious. Without the moonshine, the vegetables can either grow or taste succulent. If you ever grow things, you know, there's ways of growing things by the moon phases and the moon signs. And I used to do a lot of gardening. I was always doing like that. You plant different vegetables according to different signs of the moon, and you harvest and you plant during different phases of the moon. Like if you harvest pumpkin for the winter, you have to harvest it, I think, when the moon is waning. Otherwise, it will rot. Prabhupada says, the word rasatmaka is very significant. Everything becomes palatable by the agency of the Supreme Lord through the influence of the moon. So such an easy way to remember Krishna while eating. Let's see, where did I put this? Whenever we're eating, the taste of everything, meditate on the taste. See, the materialists are meditating on the taste just as something, oh, I'm enjoying. This is so good for my enjoyment. But we're meditating on it as Krishna. I heard Radhanath Maharaj talk about eating prasadam, how we worship the prasadam by enjoying it. And I must admit, when I heard him say that, I couldn't understand what he was saying. But it's, again, it's exactly like the cook wants to be appreciated, and the cook gets pleasure by that appreciation. Don't you all have experience of that? Anything. You know, if you decorate, you know, if your Guru Maharaj is coming and you decorate the loft here, why are you doing that? Again, you're spending money, you're spending time, you're spending effort. Why? So he can come and say, wow, that looks really nice. And the more detailed the appreciation, the more you enjoy it. If someone just said, oh, this tastes good, that's nice. But if someone says, wow, what spice do you have in here? Is that allspice? I don't know if I've ever had allspice. That really works well with the cloves. And it looks like you put some rosemary in here too, didn't you? I like that combination, the rosemary and the allspice and the cloves. And I bet it has something sweet in here too. What'd you put in here that's sweet? No, it doesn't taste like sugar. What does that taste? I think it's dates. And you're like, wow. You don't even care if you eat the food yourself, if somebody eats the food and says something like that to you, isn't it? That's what Krishna's looking for. And just thinking how I'm working on this learning to read program. Oh, my battery's dying. Do you have a couple more batteries anywhere? Two double A's. I'm thinking and working on this learning to read program how I've spent six months analyzing the words. And I thought it'll never happen, you know, no six-year-old kid using the program is ever going to have any idea what went into it. Right? Or Vaishnavi just took all of the books and categorized them in the different languages so we can have them translated. I need to get your email too so you can translate. And I thought, you know, who's going to appreciate that? Ah, very good.